This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 13 of Metatrex, Trek FM's show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me today is Mike Morrison. In this episode, we'll be discussing the nature and the mystery of consciousness in the Star Trek universe. Well, Mike, welcome to the show tonight, and I hope you're conscious enough after a long day of work to talk about consciousness.
I am conscious. I'm trying to contemplate what the mystery is. There's no mystery when it comes to consciousness, is there?
There is. We'll talk about this when we get into the topic, but what we're going to talk about tonight is what I would call the hard problem of consciousness, trying to understand how different physical systems that have physical properties can be conscious and have subjective experience, and that's the hard problem of consciousness. So there are problems with consciousness, even though there's the obvious fact that we're conscious, so we need to explain why we're conscious.
Yeah, and you know, all kidding aside, that is a tough subject. You know, how do we even know that we're conscious? That's certainly a question that has to be pondered. When we talk about, unconscious, how do we know we're unconscious?
Again, to draw out the joke a little bit, I don't know that I'm conscious until I've had my morning coffee, like Captain Janeway, you know, coffee black, none of Neelix's better than coffee substitute. And I have to listen to a Trek FM podcast on my way to work in the morning. When I've done those things, then I feel conscious.
Then you feel conscious.
I can start my day off right after those things. So that's the only problem I've got with consciousness. But
yeah, and this is going to be a fun episode because they explore this topic quite a bit through every iteration of Star Trek and even to some degree in a couple of the movies. So there's plenty for us to talk about. But before we get into the subject, today's the day, Zachary. We've been waiting on this for a little over a month now. We've been promoting this iTunes contest where we've asked our listeners to go into iTunes, give us a rating and a review. And we've gotten many, many ratings and reviews from both the U.S. stores as well as a few of the international stores, UK and Canada. And it's time to draw a name. I've got my Crawford Gray's DS9 Benjamin Sisko hat. And I have in the hat all of the reviewers who have left us star ratings and reviews. And we're going to draw one of these out in a moment. And that lucky listener is going to receive a Trek FM Word Bubble hoodie from our merch store, our Redbubble merchandise store, trek.fm/store. I'm going to plug the Redbubble store. There is a brand new, our uber talented art director, Aaron Harvey, has put a new, and it kills me because I just placed an order and then bam, all of a sudden there is this new design in there for the 50th anniversary, one of many that I'm told are soon coming to the Redbubble store. So go in and check it out. They make great gifts. You can get just about anything you can imagine with one of these incredible designs on it. Team Lizard Babies, there's Maroon Monsters, we've got a Trek FM logo, we've got the Trek Word Bubble, which is one of the items I got, a t-shirt, you can get pillows, you can get phone covers, cups, you name it, it's all available there.
And Mike, don't forget the creme de la creme of the Trek FM designs on Redbubble. We have the Pulaski banged Riker's dad design. So don't forget that. That's
I knew you were going to mention that one.
Unfortunately, the winner of the Metatrex iTunes review contest is not getting that design, but maybe we'll pull that one out for another future iTunes review contest down the road.
All right. So without further ado, Dennis, can we have a drum roll, please? All right. Here we go.
Okay, I'm taking a screenshot so I can post this on the Babel conference and on Twitter later. An action shot of you drawing the winner.
I've got it in my hand. Screenshot, please.
Got it.
There we go. All right. And the winner is Ice Mopper from the U.S. iTunes Store. 5-star review. Ice Mopper, you are going to be receiving a Trek FM hoodie, the word bubble. We're going to send it to you. We'll get an announcement out on the Babel conference, let you know you've won so you can send us your size and shipping information. We'll get that right out to you. Ice Mopper said, great podcast for Trek fans. He or she goes on to say, I've been thoroughly enjoying the episode so far and can't wait each week for more. I usually get to listen on a morning run. That's great. When the stars are still out and as I look up at them, I get insightful looks into episodes, characters, or ideas in Star Trek. Since I don't often get to talk things through with a friend in this depth, it's great to listen to the podcast to still get some discussion going. I also find the philosophy discussions to be just right. I don't have much of a philosophy background, and surprisingly, it comes up a lot in my master's architecture courses. So hearing a bit more about it in relation to something I love, like Star Trek, is a great way to learn. Keep up the great work. Thank you so much, Ice Mopper, for that great review. We're glad that we can make your morning runs insightful and enlightening, and so glad that you're enjoying the discussion. And hey, you don't have to be a philosophy expert. That's what we're here for. We're here to help you gain a better understanding of philosophy and to look at it through the lens of Star Trek. I can't think of a better pairing. Zach, anything you'd like to say?
Yeah, just I'm so amazed at the nice things people had to say about our show on iTunes, including the review just read, and we're going to read a few more at the end of the show. But just wanted to say, thanks to everyone. The reviews and the iTunes review contest. The contest is just for fun, really. You know, something to sort of reward the listeners for taking the time to give us a review. And the reviews really do help us out in helping other people find our show and getting the word out about what we're trying to do here on Metatrek. So just thank you for taking the time. We're going to run one of these review contests periodically. And now I feel actually a little self-conscious. That review is so good, and some of the other reviews I've read on iTunes in preparing for the show tonight were so good. I'm a little worried we can't live up to it now. So if we don't do that tonight, we apologize.
Yes, and of course, as we're recording this, Zachary, I'm a little saddened today at the loss of Glenn Frey. But as he would have said, the heat is on.
No pressure.
No pressure.
Well, on that note, we should probably dive into the actual topic for the show tonight, which is the nature of consciousness, or what I call the hard problem of consciousness, which is actually a term that I stole from the contemporary philosopher David Chalmers. So David Chalmers coined this phrase, the hard problem of consciousness, and that is because throughout the history of philosophy, there have been attempts to understand the nature of consciousness, really stemming all the way back to ancient philosophy, of course, but sort of the modern discussion on consciousness starts with René Descartes in the 17th century. And, throughout the centuries, in recent centuries, there have been sort of a transition from the sort of more dualist, spiritualist, metaphysical way of thinking about consciousness to trying to ground consciousness in the physical in some way. You know, with the success of neuroscience in the 20th and now 21st centuries, most contemporary work on philosophy has been the attempt to kind of explain consciousness, or how physical systems like brains, or if there's artificial intelligence in some way, or in Star Trek, android intelligence, right? How can you explain how those physical systems can have some sort of property that is self-aware, the subjective experience, not just the sort of calculating ability that the brain and other systems have, the kinds of things we discussed a couple of weeks ago when we talked about artificial intelligence mm-hmm. in Star Trek. But how can you explain the subjectivity of experience, what it's like to see red, what it's like to hear a sound, what it's like to be self-aware, and how does that property emerge out of physical systems that don't seem to have those properties at the lower level? So that is, in a nutshell, the hard problem of consciousness, as it's often referred to in contemporary philosophy.
Yeah, this is, as I said already, this is going to be a great discussion. We talk about consciousness. You know, we're talking about things like our unique identity. How do we know that we're unique? We were talking about things like emergentism when we're talking about, as we did a couple of weeks ago, artificial intelligence. We kind of touched on this, Zachary, when we were talking about emerging intelligence or emerging consciousness with artificial intelligence. That was a great discussion. We're going to delve into some episodes where we look at consciousness moving from body to body, person to person, thing to thing. That's going to be a lot of fun because I think that in and of itself raises some really interesting questions. One of the things that I want to dig into when we think about consciousness, you know, the very nature of our consciousness as it relates to different parts of ourselves, different iterations of who we are. This is something that in the episode Enemy Within from the original series, they kind of dealt with, where Captain Kirk actually gets split in two. His consciousness is literally split into two very unique, very different parts of who he is. And I want to talk about these things, and I think our listeners want to hear about that.
One thing that's amazing about Star Trek in talking about, well, philosophy in general, but this issue about consciousness in particular, is that you can really play with the idea in so many different ways. I mean, all the things you mentioned, your consciousness being split, your consciousness being transferred to another being, the collective consciousness with the Borg.
Yes.
Right? So there are countless ways that Star Trek plays with this idea of consciousness. And that's, I think, when you have, you know, 750 hours of television, right, you have a little wiggle room to explore sort of variations on a theme. You know, how many different ways can you tell a consciousness story? And this is what I like about some of the writing that Brandon Braga brought to Star Trek The Next Generation and to Voyager. I mean, some people find those episodes a little tedious because they're sort of, you know, wacky metaphysics or wacky scientific concepts turned into a story, and some people find that a little dramatically dissatisfying. But I love the attempt to sort of take an idea like consciousness and try to see how many different types of stories can you tell playing with this idea of consciousness, and different ways you can cut it up or different ways you can sort of push the boundaries of what consciousness means. And Star Trek does that very well. And you know, a lot of this probably falls in the category of Brandon Braga's weird stuff, you know, as it's been called sometimes, but that's okay. I love those stories. The philosopher in me loves those. And, I think, I'm amazed at just how much material there is there. But, you know, for me, there's this interesting fact about, you know, how many ways you can tell a consciousness story. And I'm a little concerned that maybe you can't learn as much about the philosophical, answer to that question I guess the thing I'm concerned about is how useful this the variety of types of stories you get in Star Trek that are variations on this theme, do they illuminate the answer to the fundamental question, this hard problem of consciousness? Do they help us understand the way in which consciousness as a subjective experience, you know, what it's like to be me or what it's like to be you, what it's like to have the experiences that we have, this subjective qualitative experience, are those stories helpful for understanding how that emerges out of these physical systems like brains and neural networks and whatever else instantiates consciousness inside the Star Trek universe? Do those actually help answer the philosophical question, or are they just interesting variations on a theme?
Yeah, and I think all of us at some time or another has been on the outside looking in at somebody else's life or somebody else's experiences and wondered, you know, what is it like to be him? What is it like to be her? What, you know, I tend to be a people watcher, and you know, I find myself doing that sometimes. You know, I wonder what it's like to, you know, to be that person. I think we do this to some degree with famous people. That seems to be something, at least here in the days that we're living in, where, you know, we kind of idolize people who are actors or singers, whatever, you know, whatever their talent or whatever their field of expertise might be.
Don't tell me you haven't wondered what it's like to be Patrick Stewart.
Actually, I've often wondered what it's like to be the Shat.
There's no way to know. It's one of a kind.
He's one of a kind. He's one of a kind. But yeah, I mean, you know, what is it like to have their, you know, because it's also subjective. It's not about the experiences. It's about how they relate to the experiences that they're in. And that's why you can take two people and put them in almost identical conditions. And we've done this, you know, in university experiments where we've taken, you know, uniquely different people. We've put them in exactly the same conditions, and we have noted differences in the way that they react to those conditions. And that all has to do with the inner makeup of who we are, our consciousness, how we relate to our surroundings, how we process things. And I just find this to be a fascinating topic. Let's dive in.
Well, you're touching on a few things that I find really interesting. One is the way in which this topic is related to a great many other topics in philosophy. You listed a few already. This is related to the issue of personal identity. This is related to the issue of free will and determinism that we talked about way back in episode 1 and 2 of MetaTrex. This is related to the discussion we had a couple of weeks ago about artificial intelligence and whether machines can be intelligent and be conscious. And because the issue of consciousness seems to be a sort of a touchstone issue, we're almost every other issue in philosophy is related to this in some way. It's so fundamental because it speaks to how we describe our fundamental reality, right? If reality is such that these higher levels of organization can produce new kinds of properties like consciousness, then that means we can't have the sort of reductionist, you know, physics only kind of approach to describing the universe. We have to describe it in these higher level terms, and it affects every single discipline in the sciences. You know, it affects you know, whether or not sociology and psychology add something really interesting to our description of the universe, or whether we should try to reduce all of those to more fundamental sciences. Mm-hmm. So again, almost every issue of every topic in philosophy and every discipline is related to this issue in some fundamental way. And you also hit on another feature that I think is really interesting, this sort of the first person isolation of subjective experience, right? You know, I will never know what it's like to be you, Mike. I will never know what it's like to be William Shatner or Patrick Stewart in universe, right? I can imagine what it's like to be Data. What is it like to be an android? You know, if we recognize that Data is self-aware, what kind of subjective experience does a consciousness that is generated out of a positronic brain, what is that like? You know, there's kind of this inability to understand what it's like to experience anything outside of our own consciousness. And I'm thinking of a philosopher named Thomas Nagel, who wrote this really well-known article called What Is It Like to Be a Bat? And he chose the bat as an example because it has such fundamentally different sensory apparatus than we have. You know, bats communicate and find their way around the world through sonar, right? You know, they send their signals mm-hmm. out, and they can sort of, the signals bounce back, and they can navigate, and they can experience and communicate by sonar. And, you know, and what is that experience like? What is it like to be a bat? And I think the thing that's interesting about the article is Thomas Nagel basically says, well, all we can do is imagine ourselves being a bat, right? I can imagine myself with wings, and I can imagine myself, you know, hanging upside down, whatever bats do. I can imagine myself shrieking and kind of listening for the sounds, but I don't know what it's like for a bat to be a bat. I don't, you know, I can kind of imagine myself, you know, dressed up as a bat or maybe reshaped as a bat, you know, playing a bat on the holodeck maybe. But I fundamentally don't understand what that other kind of experience is like. And that is true of creatures in general, not just of bats, right? It's true of other people. It's true of other types of beings. And you can sort of go through the list of things you get in Star Trek, right? You can go, what is it like to be captain of a starship? I have no idea. I've never done that, right? I can imagine sitting in the captain chair like I do at conventions, right? If they're carting around one of the starship bridges.
I can fantasize.
We can fantasize. I can imagine it, right? I can imagine, you know, what what is it like to be an android?
Yes.
I don't know. I could imagine myself kind of, you know, blinking in the Fourier patterns and I can imagine, you know, cocking my head certain ways, just like Data does, you know, all the behaviors, right? But I don't know what it's like to be that. I don't know what it's like to be part of a collective consciousness, right? What is it like to be assimilated by the Borg? You know, Captain Picard knows in universe, right? But, you know, we kind of not in universe and never having had those experiences fundamentally don't understand what it's like to experience other types of consciousness. And so I think one of the hard things of about talking about consciousness is just this, we're so radically isolated to our first person perspective. And all we can do is imagine ourselves having different kinds of properties, but we just plain can't experience the subjectivity that other people or other beings experience, if they experience any at all. I mean, this is related to the question of skepticism and solipsism that we talked about. Mm-hmm. And this was part of the reason that this is what is called one of the hard problems of philosophy, you know. If some day down the road this problem is solved and we really do know how consciousness is generated and how to experience what other creatures experience, I think that'll be one of the major items in philosophy checked off the list. And I think you can really, in philosophy, I think you can break these topics down into the really hard problems and the really important problems and the more trivial, more mundane problems. Even the topic we talked about last week, the meaning of life, you know, while that's important to being a human, it's a very human question, I don't think it's one of the hard problems in philosophy, right? You know, a lot of people have a lot of things to say. That topic is a little subjective, perhaps. You know, all the issues we talked about last week. But then there's the hard problems, like how does consciousness emerge out of these things that are fundamentally physical that we don't understand yet?
Yeah.
And that is just one of the really hard fundamental problems in philosophy. And will we solve it here tonight? Absolutely not. But I hope we can try to frame the issue in interesting ways in the Star Trek universe and kind of break the topic down into different, you know, theories and approaches that philosophers have taken to solving the problem of consciousness, hopefully with some good Star Trek examples. To back it up, so to speak.
Yeah, and you said if they solve this problem, you know, if they check this off the list, honestly, Zachary, I think if we check this one off the list, there are so many other philosophical problems that are tied to this. Mm-hmm. I think we won't just check one off, but we'll kill two birds with one stone, so to speak. We'll probably solve multiple. I mean, you know, we think about consciousness. Is it something more biological? Certainly I think they suggest in episodes like Spock's Brain, and we'll talk a little bit about Spock's Brain. I know that's probably not one of the most popular episodes out there with Star Trek fans, but it does raise some interesting philosophical questions. Or is it something, you know, that's more dualist, such as, you know, we talked about The Enemy Within or Turnabout Intruder, DS9, The Passenger, I think is one of those episodes where Julian Bashir is actually overtaken by the consciousness of a galactic criminal and who causes him to do criminal acts. We're going to talk a little bit about the Borg, but you know, one of the interesting character studies on this thing of consciousness for me, Zachary, is the Trill, Dax in particular. Here's the thing: you have two consciousnesses. Say that five times. No. But you do. You have two consciousnesses.
I kind of want to put a Latin ending
merged,
on it, even though that's wrong. Consciousnesses.
Yeah, consciousnesses. But you have two of them at work here in a single person, so to speak. And here's the thing that I find most interesting about this. Within the symbiote itself are all of the shared experiences of every host that symbiote has been carried by. And so for Jadzia Dax or for Ezri Dax, for our fans out there that are Ezri fans, they have the collective consciousness experiences to some degree of all of those previous hosts. What do you think about that?
You know, I think the Trill are interesting, and partly because it raises some of these fun sort of thought experiments that you might get in the literature on consciousness and in philosophy. Like, for example, one question that I have when I think about the Trill is where exactly the Trill symbiont experiences its consciousness being. Like think what it's like to be a human, right? I sort of experience consciousness kind of from my head, right? I'm located in space in a certain place. And then I have sort of sensory apparatus, you know, through my arms and other senses, right? I can kind of feel my way around the universe. But I sort of my consciousness is experienced kind of in my own head. But one thought experiment that's come up in the history of consciousness is what would happen if you had if all your sensory apparatus was remote. Suppose you were kind of it's similar to the brain in a vat example that we talked about a couple weeks ago when we talked about skepticism.
Right.
But you know, what if you were hooked up in such a way, maybe some sort of virtual reality machine where all of your sensory inputs are being fed to you through some sensory network that's located elsewhere on the other side of the galaxy or on the other side of the starship, down in the lower decks on the starship. It doesn't matter. Where would you experience your consciousness being? You know, if you're more like a dualist in some way, you might experience it being, you know, right where it is, you know, wherever your brain is, wherever that sort of sensory input is being fed to. On the other hand, if all of your experience is being fed from somewhere else, it sure seems like, you know, the things you see and the things you touch are located somewhere else, that you might very well experience your consciousness being somewhere else if all of your sensory experience is coming from somewhere else. And I can see that happening with the Trill. On the one hand, you can say, well, okay, the symbiont has its own brain, presumably. I don't know if that's ever really come up in universe, but
there's certainly an intelligence
there. There's an intelligence there, right? So is that consciousness happening down inside the abdomen of the Trill host, and that's where the Trill consciousness is located? Or is it located sort of at the level of the host, you know, where the host's brain and the host's sensory experience, or is it some combination of the two? I really don't have an answer to this question, but it's an interesting question about where the Trill's consciousness would be, given that there seems to be, that they're connected to each other in some neurological way. The symbiont, you know, navigates its way by proxy through the host sensory apparatus. So what, again, it's sort of it's what it's like to be a bat question, right? What is it like to be a Trill? I have no idea, right? But it's an interesting question where, you know, what that consciousness would be like, this sort of joint consciousness. Is it similar to the Borg? Is it a shared consciousness in that sense? A collective consciousness? Is there some division in consciousness? Are both entities self-aware at the same time, or is it literally only one consciousness that's a combination of the two? It could go either way, and I don't know if it ever really gets answered in universe, but it raises sort of the playfulness that I see in the way Star Trek deals with consciousness, right? While the answers to those questions aren't really provided in universe, it raises some really fun fodder for thinking about what is essential to the nature of consciousness. And I think, you know, part of the virtue of having these kinds of hypothetical discussions, what if I was hooked up to some sensory apparatus? What if I'm a brain in the vat? What if I'm part of the collective consciousness? It sort of teases out the things that are essential to consciousness and helps you ignore the things that are not essential to consciousness. And what does that mean for the Trill? I have no idea, except for the fact that it could go several different directions.
Yeah, and they explore this a little bit. I know, when the Dax symbiote was stolen and implanted into another Trill, I mean, immediately he was a different person. He took on, similar personality traits. He shared all of the memories of the previous hosts. And we see him kind of revert back when Dax receives the symbiote back, and immediately she experiences the torture, the sadness of his existence, not feeling complete as a Trill because he wasn't joined. In the episode from the first season entitled Dax, we see that that there is possibly some precedent that a future host can be held accountable for the actions of a previous host or symbiote. So who do we attribute the actions to? Which consciousness do we attribute those actions to? And that really kind of steers us into, and you've mentioned it a couple times, and I think we can go ahead and jump in and talk about a little bit about the Borg. Because here's one of the interesting things about the Borg. You know, first of all, they are part of a collective. They are a shared consciousness. And we understand that each of them bring, you know, their own consciousness to that collective. And it's all sort of sorted, I think is probably the best way to put it. And the Borg Queen even says that she brings, order to chaos. So you have the chaos of all of these different consciousnesses, but here's the Borg Queen bringing order to that. So, and then of course, we dig into that in the two episodes, Best of Both Worlds. As Captain Picard is assimilated into the Borg Collective, he becomes part of that shared consciousness, and they are able to use his knowledge and his experiences, and they draw on his even his emotions to some degree. And, you know, we see the struggles that he endures when he is freed from the consciousness, collective consciousness. I, Borg, when we meet the Borg Q, who is liberated from the Borg. So now we've taken him out of that shared consciousness, and he emerges once again as his own unique consciousness. And I think that is a foreshadowing of Seven of Nine. Who we'll meet in Voyager, who as a child was assimilated by the Borg, and then later with the help of Captain Janeway is liberated and reemerges as her own unique consciousness.
Now, I want to get into some of the theories behind consciousness here in a minute, but speaking of the Borg, I think one of the things that's hard to talk about regarding consciousness in the Borg is just that Star Trek seems to have handled the Borg in different ways, depending on which episode we're talking about or which series mm-hmm. we're talking about, right? On the one hand, when Picard is assimilated and he turns into Locutus, Picard seems to imply at the end of Best of Both Worlds that he was conscious through the whole thing. Maybe I'm thinking of the follow up episode Family, where he's telling his brother, "I tried so hard to stop them. I did everything I could, and I just couldn't stop them. They used me to kill and destroy." It seems to imply that he was he retained some sense of his own identity, but he was not able to control his own actions. So mm-hmm. in that sense, he wasn't sort of fully immersed in the collective consciousness. And it's not like his consciousness went away. He seemed to remain conscious of himself and his inability to act. And that seems to imply that the Borg have some sort of a controlling influence. It's kind of a top-down collective consciousness that,
yes.
you know, the individuals, drones that make up the collective consciousness may be conscious in some sense of their own identity, but they have an inability to fight against it, an inability to act, an inability to silence other voices and whatnot. And, you know, at other times, I think the Borg are portrayed more like zombies, right? And really, the Borg are zombies, especially in First Contact, right? The
sure.
Borg, it's essentially a zombie movie. And there's very little that's presented in the way of drones that seem to be conscious, right? They come across as mindless automatons that are controlled by the collective in some way. And so that's an interesting question too. I think, you know, not Picard, the one who's sort of assimilated and joins the Borg from outside, but you know, if you're immersed in the Borg from the very beginning, do you have an identity or even some sort of self-awareness, or is it almost like a John Locke tabula rasa blank slate? No self-awareness. You're just an automaton controlled by the collective. In other words, is there a self-awareness there that the drones have in any sense? And I think Star Trek goes both ways. You know, certainly they play with this concept in I, Borg, with Hugh, right? You know, Hugh regains his sense of self-identity, but mm-hmm. that doesn't really seem to answer the question of whether he was self-aware in any meaningful sense during, you know, while he's part of the collective consciousness. Same thing with Seven of Nine. You know, she seems to, you know, she was assimilated into the Borg at such a young age. You know, she had no sense of self-identity. But I'm thinking of subjective experience. Is it like something to be a Borg? You know, in the same way we've been talking about subjective experience and this hard problem of consciousness, what is it like for physical systems to have subjective experience? Do the Borg have subjective experience? Do the individual drones, are they not do they feel bad about what they're doing, but are they even aware of what they're doing? Are they conscious? Do they experience it? You know, do they have memories, or is all of their sensory experience and memory just kind of filtered down to them from the collective in some way?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I think in Star Trek, they deal with this in different ways, because as you said in First Contact, the Borg are portrayed very zombie-like. There seem to be no real consciousness there. Just
they just keep coming and coming. Right?
Mindless,
right, exactly.
Mindless automatons, mindless drones. They just keep coming. And but then, you know, we are introduced to Hugh and later Seven of Nine, and we kind of get the feeling that they are, as far as they're, it's almost as though their consciousness is imprisoned. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like it's there, but it's being overridden, or it's being suppressed in some way.
I think suppressed is probably the best way of putting it. So, yeah, I mean, we deal with this in different ways. So, you know, in some sense, you know, I think we're talking about dualism here.
Mm-hmm. I'm also thinking in terms of a similar example might be the way in which I'm thinking in Star Trek III when Spock's Katra is inside Dr. McCoy, right? Mm. You know, that's a similar kind of joint consciousness in some way. Like, you know, McCoy takes on a little bit of the mannerisms of Spock in a couple of scenes, uses a couple of Spock's terms. You know, he's clearly is containing Spock's consciousness, right? And we're not just talking about Spock's memories or Spock's vocabulary, right? In some sense, McCoy is containing Spock's consciousness, his soul, right? And they really mm-hmm. describe it in highly dualistic terms in that sense, right?
Yes,
you know, Spock's body is over here and his consciousness is transferable through a mind meld into Leonard McCoy, and he's containing Spock's identity, his personhood, his consciousness. So that's a really explicitly case where Star Trek is dualist, right? Where consciousness is defined in terms of something you can explicitly separate from whatever's going on in the body. Spock's brain didn't go along with Spock's consciousness in that example, right? Spock's brain is with his body, right, somewhere.
Yes.
On the Genesis planet. But so that's a case where Star Trek is very willing to invoke some sort of spooky metaphysical dualism, something akin to a soul, in universe. And you don't see that very often. I think in the Borg, I think you can very easily explain everything in non-dualist terms, right? You can say, well, each drone has whatever's going on in its brain, and that is somehow interfaced with the collective. And, you know, that's all physical stuff. We're all talking about electrical signals or radio signals, however the Borg communicate, subspace, mm-hmm. whatever's, right? And all of that is described in very sort of scientific lower level terms. And somehow all of that affects the drone's brain, and the drone acts a certain way, and its consciousness is suppressed. But I don't think you need to invoke anything sort of spooky metaphysical dualist in order to explain the Borg. Whereas with Spock, they go full on dualist, right? Spock's consciousness is totally separate from his body. It's contained in Dr. McCoy. You can ask these interesting what is it like to be a bat questions. What is it like to have someone else's consciousness in your body, right? I have no idea against the what it's like to be a bat problem. I have no idea. But so Star Trek, I think, is willing to go dualist. And I think this is important for the history of philosophy, because the history of thinking about consciousness starts with dualism. It's with Descartes' arguments for dualism, that you can sort of doubt all the existence of your body and the external world, all the skeptical doubts that we talked about a couple of episodes ago when we talked about skepticism and the external world. And then you're forced into all kinds of these hard problems. And the reason that people have kind of moved away from dualism, one problem is just the interaction problem. Well, if Spock's consciousness is totally separate from his body, right, how does his consciousness affect his body? You know, when they're conjoined, not when they've been separated, but when Spock's been reunified with his body, once his catcher has been reimplanted back in his body, how does his consciousness affect what's going on in his brain and affect what's going on in his body? such that he controls what his body does. And we all seem to do that. I make decisions and I my body does something, right? If I say to myself, Zach, I want a sandwich, I get up and I go to the kitchen and I get a sandwich, right? But how, if we take dualism, in a very strong sense, this strict mind body substance dualism that Descartes had, and that seems to be implied in Star Trek, 2 and 3, how is that kind of interaction possible if the mind is something fundamentally non-physical and is totally separate from your brain? Then how, and given that they have different types of properties, right? If one is physical and has all these spatial properties, like it, you know, your brain weighs something, it has a certain amount of mass and all the things you can do with science to investigate the brain, right? If your consciousness is different from all of that and has totally different properties, things like subjective experience and things like, I don't know, feelings and desires and intentions and experiences, you know, if that's the kind of stuff that your consciousness has, and that's different from your brain, that's what dualism is saying, right? They're totally different things.
Yes.
How does one affect the other given that they have no properties in common? And that, so the interaction problem is one of the really, really hard problems of consciousness on a dualist perspective. You're forced into explaining the obvious thing, the obvious insight that we at least seem to can have an effect on what our body does, right? In a very day-to-day ordinary sense, I make a decision and my body does something. And right. On a dualist account, those two things aren't unified, the consciousness and the body, right? Whereas on almost every other account of consciousness that we'll talk about here in a minute, these more physicalist, materialist accounts of consciousness, there's no separation there. You know, the goal is to try to explain consciousness and intention and behavior purely in physical terms. So that kind of eliminates the problem if you can succeed in really explaining how consciousness is possible in physicalist terms. But I think with dualism, you just have this really, really hard problem of explaining how the two interact with each other, given that they have totally different properties. And again, the answer is not found in Star Trek, right? You don't get this deep,
exactly.
You know, philosophical discussion in universe of how Spock's Katra interacts with his brain and leads Spock to do the things Spock does. But it does raise these really, really hard questions. And in the history of philosophy, those questions have been so hard that philosophers have essentially moved away from dualist perspectives towards more physicalist theories. And in the history of philosophy of mind in the 20th and 21st century now, by far physicalist or materialist theories are the norm. But again, I want to emphasize that this makes the problem even harder, right? Because, you know, if you're trying to explain something like consciousness and the subjectivity of experience, the what it's like to be me or what it's like to be you or what it's like to be a bat or what it's like to be a Vulcan, right? Then you're forced into explaining, well, how does that subjectivity, that experience arise from something that has all these different properties, these physical properties, you know, like neural networks and the things they do and input output functions and the things they do. And so it's proven to be just as hard of a problem, I think is the point. That now the goal, the hope was that these non-dualist physicalist positions could eliminate the problems of dualism, all the things, the problems that they're raised by this dualism that we talked about with Spock a minute ago. But it turns out that approach has raised problems that are essentially just as hard to solve, how subjectivity can arise from something that's purely physical in terms.
Well, and that's kind of where I'm at on this topic, because I have for most of my adult life had a dualist slant, but I cannot deny the science of the brain, and we talked about this in a previous episode. I mean, it's a scientific fact. It is a documented scientific fact that when you alter, chemistry of the brain, when you alter the physiology, the makeup of the brain in any way, an insult, a head injury, a lobotomy, whatever the case may be, when you make a change to the brain, oftentimes the very personality of the person who is it's fundamentally changed. So you cannot deny that science that says, you know, that there is a physicalist explanation here. But I find that very unsatisfying as well as an answer to the problem. So I'm kind of stuck here in the middle because I see strengths and weaknesses with both of these. And on my Ben Franklin balance sheet, it's kind of an even slate right now. You mentioned Star Trek III and, you know, that kind of dualist take on Spock and his Katra. You touched on, and I mentioned earlier, Spock's brain, where without getting into, you know, a full synopsis of the episode, it seems that Spock's consciousness and his brain are connected. His brain's stolen. And he is left in, you know, a vegetable, so to speak. But in his consciousness has gone with his brain, and is now in the hands of the thief.
And that in a way seems to contradict what we've seen.
It does.
You're right, because if you can separate Spock's consciousness from his brain, like you seem to see in Star Trek 2 and 3, that seems to imply that your consciousness is not essentially tied to, you know, where your brain happens to be spatially located, right? But in Spock's brain, when they remove Spock's brain, his consciousness goes with the brain.
Yeah.
They seem to be really linked in some way. And this is, you know, the philosopher René Descartes, who is the canonical dualist in the history of philosophy, you know, he ran into this problem. You know, the obvious question is, well, it sure seems like consciousness is tied to the brain in some way, so how are they connected to each other?
Mm-hmm.
And Descartes' answer was actually a really, really bad answer.
Yeah.
He kind of hand-waved. He basically said, well, there's this gland called the pineal gland, and that's where the consciousness and the brain are tied together. And you sort of go, well, that makes no sense, right? How is the consciousness tied to this physical gland? It doesn't really solve the problem of how consciousness is tied to your brain. But you hit the nail on the head. I mean, that if consciousness is essentially in a very strong way tied to whatever's going on in the brain, and even stronger than that, if your consciousness is fully determined by what's going on in your brain's state, right? And this is how I think contemporary philosophers, physicalist philosophers, and a lot of neuroscientists talk about consciousness. They talk about brain states, you know, the sum totality of the things that are going on in your brain, you know, the state of every neuron and how they're connected together. Take all of that into account, and that determines what's going on in your consciousness at any given moment. So in that sense, you can think of consciousness as being the determining sort of lower level that, you know, at any given moment you have a brain state, and that determines your consciousness state, which is, mm-hmm. I'm going to throw a word out there, and I hate to throw a lot of terms out there. I really make a conscious effort to avoid using sort of hefty technical terms when we talk about philosophy here on Metatrex, but I'm going to use one because I think it's a really important term. The term is epiphenomenalism.
Mm-hmm.
And the essence of that view, epiphenomenalism, it's E-P-I-P-H-E-N-O, let's see, I can't even spell it now, epiphenomenalism. I'm not even going to try it. The idea is that whatever's going on in your brain fully determines whatever's going on in your consciousness. But the mental component of that, the thing that's being determined, itself has no causal impact downward, right? So causation kind of goes bottom up in that sense, and the consciousness kind of floats above whatever's going on in your brain, but itself doesn't cause anything to happen. And you can see the immediate tensions you get into. We really want to retain some sense of mental causation, right? I do want to. We like to hold people responsible for things, right? You know, if someone commits a crime, we want to be able to say, "Hey, you're responsible for your crime because your actions were caused by whatever's going on in your consciousness."
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, when I get up and go get a sandwich, I want to think, you know, my decision to get a tuna sandwich versus a chicken sandwich, or, you know, in Star Trek terms, right? Do I order coffee black, or do I order Neelix's better than coffee substitute, right? When I make a decision like that, what is determining that? I want the individuality of me wants it to be the case that that decision stems from me, and that my consciousness is the cause of those actions, right? And if the mind is just sort of floating above your consciousness and determined by whatever's going on in your brain, it's hard to give an account of how your consciousness in turn causes something to happen downward inside the brain, and eventually, you know, flowing onto whatever your body does. And that is the there's a problem called the problem of causal exclusion that was actually the topic of my dissertation. I didn't actually finish my PhD, but I got, you know, several chapters of it done, and got sidetracked by working in education publishing from then on. But my original dissertation topic was on mental causation. Mm-hmm. And one of the fundamental problems of mental causation is this, what's called the problem of causal exclusion. And the idea is just that, given that every physical event seems to have physical causes to it, right? You know, when we talk about an event happening in the world, we go looking for other physical causes. And the idea, one sort of well-accepted, you know, assumption is that every physical cause has a fully determining physical effect, right? You can explain that in totally physicalist terms, whatever happens. And we also want to hold on to this idea that the mind causes something to happen. And, you know, neuroscience has told us a lot about the way in which consciousness is determined by what's going on in the brain. So now you've got a case of kind of competing causes, right? You know, from moment to moment to moment, you can sort of think of the progression of brain states. You know, I've got a brain state at this moment. Then a few minutes later, I got a different brain state. And there's kind of this physical chain of causation that leads from brain state to brain state to brain state to brain state a long time. And then at each of those moments, my consciousness is arising out of whatever's going on in my brain. And if I also want to think, well, my mind causes, my mind, the mental properties, the experience causes something to happen, it causes future brain states as well. Now you've got a case of competing causes. It looks like for any given brain state, you can trace it back to previous brain states on a purely physical level. But if we want to hold some sense of intentionality, we also have to be able to say, well, my mind causes future brain states to happen. That's what causes, when I make a conscious decision, an intentional decision, it sure looks like we want to hold on to some sense of mental causation as well. And now you've got a case of competing causes. And the problem is basically that, well, it sure looks like if every brain state or every physical event is fully determined by previous physical events or previous brain states, there's nothing sort of left over for the mind to cause that can't be explained in purely physical terms. And it kind of squeezes mental causation out of the picture. And, you know, and I think that my point is just that that's a really unsatisfying picture, right? We really want to hold on to some robust sense of being able to cause things mentally that are our minds make some effect in the physical world in some way.
Right, because you're kind of touching on behaviorism there.
Yeah, and again, I want to break this down into different types of physicalist theories, because this is this problem arises on a view called non-reductive physicalism. The idea that the mental properties arise out of physical properties. They're determined by physical properties. Themselves, they might be higher level physical properties, not in some sort of spooky dualist sense. They might be, you know, higher level consciousness properties that are fundamentally something physical, you know, like a complex emergent property. But the idea is that if they're not just plain reducible to something at a lower level, just reducible to those brain states that I talked about, then it seems like there's nothing kind of left over for them to cause that can't be explained totally at a lower level. And I guess my point is that's just a totally dissatisfying picture. You know, you mentioned before that when you think about this issue, when you think about the dualist view that you have held and seem to hold in some ways, and as you think about, compare that to what we're learning about consciousness through neuroscience, mm-hmm. they don't seem to add up. And that's just another way of making the same point, that when we look at the explanatory causal factors for how events in the world or events in our brains seem to unfold, you do have a case of competing causes. You can explain almost everything in purely lower level physical terms, and yet we do really depend on this sense of mental causation in some non-reducible sense. Our sense of personal responsibility, our sense of personal identity, our sense of intentionality. These are concepts that you can't just sweep under the rug. You know, imagine what a human life would be like without personal identity or intentionality. It'd be zombie-like, right?
Right.
And we're not zombies, right? We have these properties, and yet it doesn't seem to be the case that we can give a great account of how those higher level non-reducible properties that we desperately want to hold on to, because so much of our experience and worldview seems to depend on them. It doesn't seem like there's much room for them given the large success of this reductionist attempt to explain causation purely at the lower level. In other words, you know, at best, I think if that problem holds water, if there's not some problem with the way that problem is set up, then at best, our minds are just kind of floating up here. We might have subjective experience, but it's sort of impotent. It doesn't cause anything to happen mm-hmm. in the world. And that's not a very satisfying picture. So a corollary to this hard problem of consciousness, I think, is the problem of mental causation, how causation can happen from whatever the mind is, you know, whether it's dualism or whether it's emergent non-reductive properties, whatever we end up spelling out what consciousness is, it's not enough just to kind of say it exists and it doesn't cause anything. I think we lose so much of our worldview if that's the case. And again, that doesn't just make it true. That might actually be the answer, right? It might be that our minds don't actually cause anything. And all of the causation that we see in terms of how our brains work and how our bodies work and how we interact with the world, maybe all of that is fully deterministic and spelled out. This is why it's so related to the free will determinism discussion from way back in episode 1 and 2 of Metatrex, because it might very well turn out that all the physical stuff, the brain and the body and the external world, is all fully determined, right? You can't control any of that. And our consciousness is just floating up here, you know, not disembodied, but unable to cause anything to happen. It might even be such that it seems like we're causing something to happen, but that's a total illusion, right? Mm-hmm. That might be the final answer at the end of the day. But I think that's kind of a last resort. You know, you don't want to give into that answer too easily, because so much of our worldview seems to depend on intentionality and mental causation. So, all of this is just to say that this is a really, really hard problem. It's hard to explain what consciousness is, first of all. And a corollary to that is it's hard to explain how consciousness can cause anything to happen in the world, given this very successful physicalist program that's happened in the last 50 or 100 years in the history of philosophy and the history of neuroscience.
But, you know, I agree that, you know, Descartes kind of thumbs his nose at this problem to some degree, you know, with the whole thing of the pineal gland. But at the same time, I think he could have possibly been onto something, in that he was trying to draw, I believe, from, you know, from what I've read of his theory on this, I think he was trying to draw a connection point between the physical and the non-physical. I think he was trying to reconcile, and I sort of feel his pain, Zachary, because I think he was caught in the middle where, you know, he's dualist, but, you know, doggone it, you just can't ignore the science. And so I think he was trying to reconcile the two and finding a point of connection where the two kind of work together in chorus. I don't know. I've heard rumblings that, you know, the JJ Trek Beyond actually has a subtitle, Spock's Pineal Gland.
That's awesome. There's the show title right there.
Spoiler alert.
Metatrex 13, alert. Spock's Pineal Gland. We'll see if that comes to fruition or not. Who knows? But what I want to do now, Mike, I want to spend some time sort of going over some of the different non-dualist, the physicalist or materialist responses to this problem of consciousness. And again, this is a podcast on Star Trek and philosophy, so I want to try to do it in Star Trek terms. And I think the best way to do that might be to revisit our discussion from a couple of weeks ago on artificial intelligence, machine intelligence, and consciousness. Because while we didn't go into the theories of consciousness, we did touch upon this epistemological or this knowledge-based question of how you can know non-living beings are conscious, that they're self-aware, that they're intelligent, right? And I think if we frame this discussion of physicalist theories in terms of something like, how do we know data is conscious? What are the different ways of interpreting this claim that data is a conscious being? We can kind of spell out these different interpretations of different physicalist theories, all in terms of data or in terms of some other artificially intelligent life form in Star Trek. But I think data is the go-to example, right?
Oh, yeah.
Everyone's a fan of data and Brent Spiner. And so I'm going to try to do this in terms of data. So real quick, the rundown of theories that I want to talk about here in the time remaining for the show are identity theory, behaviorism, functionalism. We mentioned non-reductive physicalism already a minute ago, and emergentism. And that is not an exhaustive list of all the different types of non-reductive physicalist theories that are out there, all the different types of materialist theories, but it covers the vast majority of different approaches to how to explain consciousness in physicalist terms. So the first one I want to dive into is identity theory. And, you know, the name identity sort of implies, well, two things are the same thing, right? Like an identity in mathematics is something like A equals A, right? It's a self-identity. And so the easy answer to, if you want to reject dualism, right? If we're not going to go the direction of spooky metaphysics and dualist properties here, but the easy way to explain the relationship between mind and body, or between mental properties and physical properties, or between the mind and the brain, is just to put an equal sign between the two and say right. That literally consciousness or the mind or mental states just are whatever the heck is going on in the brain, right? They're literally the same thing. And we might have two ways of describing them, two different types of vocabulary, this mental vocabulary with things like intentions and feelings and desires, all the language we use to describe mental events. Then we have all the language we use to describe the brain, like brain states and, you know, neuron firings and all this rich physicalist language. And the easy solution has been just to put an equal sign between the two and say, well, the one is literally the same thing as the other. We just have two different ways of describing the very same thing. And there is right. No problem. There aren't two things to explain the relationship between them. It's literally just that one is the same thing as the other, and we have two ways of describing it. So with data, you know, what does it mean? What is data's consciousness? Mm-hmm. You would literally have to point to his positronic brain and say that.
Right. That.
You know, whatever's going on in data's positronic brain, that is data's consciousness. It's not that it's located somewhere else like dualism. It's not that it's an emergent property kind of floating above it in some way. It's literally you point to his positronic brain and you say that is data's consciousness.
Right.
And then the question is that a satisfying answer? Does that explain everything we want to explain with consciousness? Or does that solution leave out something important about the nature of consciousness?
Yeah, certainly not in a Star Trek universe, because you in universe, you ignore so many great stories like Turner Broad Intruder, Enemy Within, I think Tuvix to some degree, The Passenger, Body and Soul from Voyager.
I think you're right. So again, there's two ways of answering this question, right? There's the in-universe approach, like what does Star Trek itself have to say about this, and what kinds of stories and what kinds of examples do you get in-universe? And I think you're right that in-universe you can find counterexamples to this left and right, right? All the things you mentioned, Spock's Katra that we mentioned, you can find these examples. Mm-hmm. You know, presumably, if the mind and the body are literally identical, you couldn't separate the two. So any way of taking consciousness and putting it sort of spatially somewhere else other than the brain that and again, on identity theory, just the brain is the consciousness, right?
Right.
So there's no way to put that consciousness spatially anywhere else other than the brain.
Right. Right?
Even something like, you know, the William Riker and Thomas Riker being split into two individuals.
I was thinking about that.
How would that work, right? If the consciousness literally is the brain, well, I guess maybe you could explain that in terms of identity theory, because, you know, once the brain is duplicated, you could have another consciousness that is identical to the duplicate brain. So that may not be a counterexample, but anything that's kind of creeping up on dualism where the consciousness is located somewhere other than the neural patterns that generate that consciousness, presumably in universe, those would be counterexamples to identity theory in Star Trek.
Yeah, because I think as Data would put it, for 0.06 seconds, Thomas and Will Riker were
0.6 seconds
equal. Yeah. They were identical, right. And to which Captain Picard would say, "Is that a very long time?" And Data says, "Sir, to an android, that's eternity."
Well, and I think it's an easy solution because it's an attractive solution because it's easy, right? It just solves the problem. If there aren't two things, then there's no problem of how one generates the other, right? So in that sense, it would be a solution. But I think there's something a little unsatisfying about it, right? Because there's something, it's not just that I think when we think about the subjective experience of consciousness, right? I think of the subjectivity of it, right? It feels like something to be consciousness, right? Experiencing an experience feels conscious, right? You know, there's a qualitativeness to it that the description of what's going on in the brain doesn't seem to convey that, right? Neurons firing don't convey consciousness to me. They don't convey subjective experience to me. Putting the brain on a platter and weighing it because it has mass, right? These purely physicalist mm-hmm. properties don't connote self-awareness or subjective experience to me. And there's such a rich... yeah, I mean, history of subjectivity. This is the history of the human condition, right? We're conscious beings, right? That's what makes us distinctive right. in some way from the rest of the things that we see in the universe that aren't conscious. What makes me different from the computer sitting on my desk, right? I think there's something important about this subjective experience. And what's unsatisfying about this approach is it kind of eliminates the uniqueness of that subjective experience, right? It just says all that is just the brain stuff. You know, that in my mind doesn't really do respect to the qualitative difference of subjective experience. And of course, there's kind of a subtle nuance here, because on the one hand, you could be what you would call eliminativist, right? You try to eliminate the vocabulary of mental talk, right? And so one approach here is just say, well, the mind is identical to the brain. Oh, and we don't need that mental talk anymore. We just need to know more about the brain, because that's all consciousness is in the first place. You know,
Yeah, and I think we see that in DS9 with Beryl, mm-hmm. Zachary, because as they replaced parts of his brain with, you know, positronic replacements, his subjective experiences, his, for instance, a touch wasn't the same to him. And at the end of the episode, even Dr. Bashir says to Curie, you know, if I remove any more of this guy's brain and replace it with a positronic implant, the Barao, you know, will cease to exist. He will no longer be Barao. He'll be something or someone else.
Yeah. If it's conscious at all at that point, right?
Yes, exactly.
And that's an open question. Maybe, you know, we talked about this when we were talking about artificial intelligence. Maybe there are machines that are complicated enough to have these emergent properties and be conscious too. Mm-hmm. But so it's an open question whether that being would be conscious, but it wouldn't be Barao anymore, maybe, right? It would be a different type of consciousness if it's conscious at all.
So how about behaviorism?
So behaviorism is kind of a maybe the next level of subtlety in terms of trying to explain consciousness in terms of something physical. And like the name implies, behaviorism emphasizes the behavioral aspect of having certain mental states. So you could take any given mental state you want. And again, we're talking with data, right? So take data with his emotion chip, maybe, because it will get better examples with the emotion chip. So data with his emotion chip is feeling joyful, or he's feeling sad, right? It doesn't matter. He's got some feeling that he's having. What does it mean afraid to have that emotion or have that mental state? On the behaviorist theory, basically the definition of these mental states, whether they're emotions or intentions, whatever mental state you want to come up with, all of those are defined in terms of their behavior. So if data is sad, that will manifest itself in certain behaviors that data has. I'm trying to think what would it mean for data to be. I can picture data kind of like hanging out in 10 forward, drinking a non-syntholic beverage, you know, a green non-syntholic beverage, crying in it, you know, he's weeping his yellow tears in his green drink. Guinan's got to come over and give him a pep talk. You know, but my point is this is going to manifest itself in some way. It's not just like data is going to stand there silent, not moving, and be sad. On the behaviorist theory, any mental state always manifests itself in external physical behaviors in some way, biological, you know, behaviors of our body. You know, if data is feeling silly, he's going to make bad jokes about tricorders, right? These are Mr. Tricorder, right? That is data's behavior of having a certain mental state with his emotion chip. But the point is that the mental state is always defined in terms of the behaviors. And so what that view precludes is the possibility that there are mental states that don't manifest themselves in behavior in some way. So with data, it's interesting. Like I'm picturing data, that episode Unification, where Data and Picard are going to Romulus to find Spock, and Picard is trying to sleep, and Data's standing there motionless, and it's kind of creeping Picard out, right? He's processing all this information, just standing there with his eyes open, kind of staring in Picard's direction. Behaviorism really precludes the possibility that there are mental states that don't manifest themselves in behavior in some way. And the mental states are just defined in terms of those behaviors. So if you want to say pick any mental state you want, what does it mean to be happy or sad or joyful or hopeful or whatever, that is going to be defined in terms of whatever behavior. And it's really complex, right? There's complex nuances in those mental states. There's complex nuances in our behavior. So it's not that it's an overly simplistic kind of one-to-one match between, you know, happiness always means, you know, making tricorder jokes, and and sadness always means crying yellow tears in your green drink and 10 forward. It's more nuanced than that, because different people have slightly different variations on those mental states, and those behaviors manifest themselves in many different ways. But the idea is that for any given mental state you want, however nuanced it is, that it will always manifest itself in some very nuanced behavior. And in that sense, the mental states don't have any nature that isn't automatically defined in terms of something physical. So in that sense, it's non-dualist, because it's not that those mental states are contained in some non-physical dualist consciousness somewhere. It's that those mental states are inherently grounded in whatever physical behaviors you manifest.
Yeah, when you mentioned the difference between those behaviors, those mental states, and I know it kind of calls back to the mind-body dualism part of our discussion, but a fun episode that comes to mind for me is Body and Soul, in which the doctor is and here we are in a Star Trek world, downloaded into Seven's corticonoid and node rather, and she. This is just
some of her best acting ever. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Jeri Ryan as an actress, I think she really showed her chops there, because she just completely pulled the doctor off, I think, better than the doctor. But, just seeing the difference in the way that she handled the experiences, and that's how we knew that she was the doctor, because she was experiencing those things in different ways. The mental state was different for her.
Yeah.
When she was being controlled by the doctor.
And I think behaviorism sometimes doesn't get quite enough credit, mainly because of the complexity. On its worst, there's kind of the simple correspondence between mental states and fairly simplistic behaviors, but people are more nuanced than that, right? The doctor's behaviors are going to manifest differently than Seven of Nine's behaviors, and that's how you can tell she's portraying the doctor in that episode, right? The subtlety of the behaviors and the nuances and the mannerisms and whatnot. And those mannerisms are tells to your behavior. Those are the things that allow us to, if that weren't the case, we would never be able to have any sense at all of what's going on in someone's mind, right? The fact that people manifest their mental states through behavior is what gives us any insight at all into what it's like to be someone else. It's how you can empathize. It's how you can sympathize. It's because you can look at people's behaviors and you can understand their mental states. You can infer something about their mental states from that. And, happily, if behaviorism is true, that opaqueness of what it's like to be someone else, lack of clarity about experiencing what it's like to experience someone else's experiences, kind of goes away if behaviorism is true, because you can infer certain things about mental states from people's behavior. And in fact, those mental states are just defined in terms of those behaviors. So you can see why for early psychology, behaviorism was an attractive theory, right? Because you could, by analyzing people's behavior, you can learn something interesting about their consciousness, because they're so closely related, and the consciousness always manifests itself in behavior in some way, however subtle. I think that the rise of modern psychology in the early 20th century is intimately tied up with behaviorism in the sense. It's hard to see how psychology can get off the ground if something like behaviorism isn't true. And whether you read that sort of metaphysically and say that the mind just is these behaviors, or whether it's just that there's some deep connection between the two, is an open question. But behaviorism is often viewed, I think, as a simplistic theory that doesn't do justice to the complexity of mental states. But, mental states are complex and nuanced, and behaviors are complex and nuanced. Sure. And individualistic. So I do think behaviorism kind of, is given a short shrift, so to speak, in general. Mm-hmm. But I'm still skeptical of it. I still generally think that behaviorism doesn't do justice to the subjectivity itself. There's something qualitatively different to be conscious, and that's different from the physical properties that are instantiated when a certain behavior happens, right? The data's sadness, right? If Data's consciousness and he's got his positronic brain and that's producing consciousness, subjectivity, and experience, the quality of that experience is still different from whatever behaviors that he's got going on, right? There's the language, in other words, is richer than that. I guess part of my problem with all of these physicalist theories is that the language, it's almost like the language doesn't really refer to anything. When I say sadness, mm-hmm. That points to something that's in my mind, that points to something that's qualitatively unique, is something that's tied up with what it's likeness of having that mental state. Whereas when I point to physical things like the behaviors, I can say, okay, I can measure how long it takes for Data to sip his drink, and I can measure how long it takes for Guinan to come over and comfort him. And, all these physical things just have sort of physical properties you can measure and analyze in purely physicalist terms. And none of that seems to do justice to this referential component, that the language about sadness and happiness and mental states and intentions seems to point to something in my mind that is qualitatively unique. And all of these, I worry, kind of they're trying to explain away that uniqueness of consciousness and subjectivity. Mm-hmm. And certainly that's going on with behaviorism, right? If you're just defining mental states in terms of behaviors, then that kind of ipso facto is explaining away the subjectivity of those mental states. And that doesn't seem to match up with my experience of what it's like to be conscious, because I think anyone who sort of turns in, and this is where Descartes' dualism, and even the dualism that we saw in thinking about Spock in Star Trek 2 and 3, right? Spock's Katra. The insight that view has is that when you turn your mind inward, you think, when you sort of close your eyes and bracket out all the physical stuff, and you realize there's something that it's like to be conscious, right? That it feels like something. It seems like something. And if that's not just an illusion or something to be explained away, then all of these physicalist theories have a hard time doing justice to that. I think that's true of behaviorism.
Yeah. Well, Zachary, we are past an hour, and we still have a couple of physicalist theories we want to touch on. And do we want to discuss those briefly as we wind down the show today with some final thoughts?
I think so. I think we can actually squeeze a couple of these in here real quick and not keep our listeners here too long. Yeah. We do want to keep the show brief and concise. But the other two big theories that I want to talk about are functionalism and emergentism. And emergentism, we've really already talked about, right? We've talked about this notion that the mind somehow is an emergent higher level property that emerges out of whatever's going on in the brain. We talked about that when we talked about artificial intelligence in the Chinese room example a couple of weeks ago. So, we talked about what emergentism is, the idea that there are higher level emergent properties. On this view, there's still physical properties, because we're not talking about dualism, we're talking about physicalism still. And then we have all the problems that you'd expect of explaining how emergent properties emerge and why they're different from the lower level properties and how they cause things to happen in the physical world. It's an attractive view, I think, because you still end up with properties that are physical in nature, right? It's just that I think when we try to describe the physical world, oftentimes we kind of implicitly do it in a reductionistic kind of way, right? We sort of think of it's. Are you a fan of the show The Big Bang Theory, Mike?
I've watched it, yeah.
So the scientists on there, Sheldon Cooper and Leonard Hofstadter,
yeah.
they're theoretical physicists, right? And they tend to think that the fundamental level of reality is physics, that everything is just reducible to physics, and every other science is not as fundamental and doesn't study as things, they're not as true as physics. And if people were really smart, they'd be studying physics, right? And that's kind of this view that emergentism is trying to get away from. I think emergentism it wants to hold on to a physicalist view. It's not spooky dualism, but it wants to say, look, reality, the physical reality is just more complex than that. You can't just reduce everything to atoms. That doesn't do justice to what we see in the physical world. The physical world is hierarchical. At each new level of hierarchy, each level of complexity, there are new kinds of properties that emerge, and new kinds of behaviors, and new kinds of properties that are instantiated. And all of those are not reducible, but they're all still physical properties. They're not just that reality is fundamentally more complicated with different types of properties than this purely lower level type of description. So I think of these theories, that's one of the most attractive views for me, because it does do justice to the different nature of higher level properties, but still tries to just relabel them as physical properties and try to expand our view of what counts as a physical property to include things like mental properties and things like complex behaviors and whatnot. Again, it still has all the problems of all the other theories, but it probably has the best shot of explaining the qualitativeness of subjective experience compared to these more reductionist theories. So the last one I want to mention is functionalism. And I think this is it's really easy to explain, and it's hard to, again, it's just hard to see how it does justice to subjective experience. And just like the name implies, functionalism, it has to do with functions, which are inputs and outputs. And it's great that we're talking about data with this theory, because this is essentially what data does, right? If data
because it's a matter of programming.
It's a matter of programming, where data has a positronic brain that has been programmed. He has subroutines. He writes new subroutines for himself, but it's all defined in terms of programs, right? And programs are inherently defined in terms of input and output conditions, right? And there's different ways of programming, different styles of programming, different theories about programming. But a function at its basic is an input-output relationship. You put an input in, some processing goes on and you get an output out. And that's mm-hmm. the idea behind functionalism, that we have certain, our consciousness has certain inputs, the things we get from our senses, the things we experience in our discussions with other people, the communication, all this stuff that's feeding into our minds, are the inputs of functions. And,
right.
and for functionalists, this is a massively complex function, right? Think of the many, many types of sensory input you're getting at any single moment of your consciousness. We're not talking one or two inputs. We're talking thousands or millions or billions of types of sensory input that are inputs to this function that defines your mind. And then there's an output, right? The things you say and your responses and the behaviors, the kinds of things that behaviorists were really, really interested in, and your response to the various types of stimuli and various types of inputs. And so functionalists literally tried to define consciousness in terms of functions, that you take this massive complex network of inputs and outputs, this huge complexity of inputs, all the if-then statements that dictate what the outputs are under those input conditions, all the complex behaviors that emerge out of the outputs, and you wrap a big circle around all of that and call it a big functional diagram. And mm-hmm. we're talking bigger than you could put on a whiteboard, right? We're talking massively complex. If you look at the complexity of human consciousness, but you wrap a big circle around it, however big it is, and you put an arrow to it, and you say that's consciousness. all it is a big complex network of input and output conditions. And that's the end of the story. So when you say, what does it mean to be sad? You say, well, what are the inputs? What are the conditions under which that mental state emerges? What are the behaviors that emerge out of that? What are the outputs? What are the things Data does in 10 forward when he's sad? What happened, what happened to the turbo lift that made Data cry, right?
Yeah.
But you put a big circle around all of that, the inputs and outputs, and you say, you want to know what sadness is? It's not spooky dualism. It's not something, it's not a katra that we're housing, over on Vulcan somewhere. It's just this network of inputs and output conditions. It's a big, massive, complex function. And again, it's really attractive because if artificial intelligence is possible, a couple of things. If it's possible to define our intelligence in terms of these functional diagrams, if it's possible to define Data's intelligence in terms of these functional diagrams, we should be able to program computers to be conscious, right? We can mimic these input and output conditions. This is what programming does really well, right? It takes inputs, processes them, and spits out an output. If we can get better and better processors, maybe we can really mimic, not even mimic, we can just develop machines that have these functional diagrams that are essentially the exact same diagrams that reflect what we do. So that's functionalism. It's just this idea that it's not purely behaviors. It's not emergent properties. It's just that you define any mental state you want in terms of whatever complex set of inputs generate that mental state and whatever complex behaviors emerge out of that mental state. Put a big circle around all of that. Call it a function and a set of inputs and outputs. And that is all it means to be conscious or to have certain mental states. It's very attractive because you can really replicate that with machines. And so it's tied up with a sense of artificial intelligence. But my concern is still just that it leaves out the essence of consciousness, which is the subjective experience. I look at a big functional diagram, however complex it is, and I think to myself, how can that be conscious? How can that see red? How can that be sad? Right?
Right.
There's still kind of this mental epistemological gap in my mind of, the sort of physical description or the functional description of a mental state and then the experience of that mental state. And again, you can kind of do this in a reductionist kind of way where you can eliminate the talk all you want. Just go, oh, sadness, that's not a real thing. All that means is all this functional stuff, right? and you can point to Data and you say, well, Data's not sad. He's just behaving in this way because of these conditions. It's not sadness, right? But there's kind of a non-eliminativist sense of it where you can say, well, we recognize that people have these mental states and have this experience, but we do want to understand what generates it. We want to understand what flows from it. The only sense of understanding we could give is this kind of functional understanding. And I think functionalists are much more comfortable with just kind of saying, hand-waving and saying, we're never going to understand this subjective part. you know, it's a total, it's like the, what it's like to be a bat problem, right? That's just,
yeah, exactly.
That's an unsolvable problem. But what we can do is analyze the input and output conditions that generate those mental states and define those mental states. And it's very tied up with the success of programming. So, you know, if there are any programmers out there listening to this, you might go, oh, functionalism. Yeah, I could replicate a lot of that. I could write programs to do all those things, right? and so it's a very attractive view because you can sort of go, it can gives us progress in analyzing our own mental states. It also gives us potential progress in developing artificially intelligent machines or androids like Data. But again, when you ask the really hard question, but is that consciousness, right? Is that subjective experience? Is there a qualitativeness to that? Then you kind of go, well, I don't see how. And so that, I think at the end, you know, insofar as I have final thoughts, you mentioned we should get to final thoughts and you're right. We want to wrap up the show here, but my final thoughts on all of these physicalist theories are that they just plain don't do justice to the nature of consciousness. And that, you know, in the Star Trek universe, you know, there are, you know, countless dualist examples that in universe, right? Clearly, I think Star Trek as a whole doesn't have a purely physicalist view. We see dualism left and right.
No, it certainly
right?
doesn't.
But again, in the real universe now, I sort of worry that these physicalist theories just don't have what it takes to explain consciousness. And yet the goal, I think, should still be to try to avoid the spooky dualism. I think dualism is an even worse situation than any of these physicalist theories, because at least these physicalist theories do justice to the fact that whatever's going on in the brain is intimately tied up with whatever is going on in our consciousness, right? And neuroscience has been very successful because of that. The question is, how the hell does that work and how the hell does that produce consciousness? But with dualism, I think the problem is just totally worse, right? You've got this totally non-physical thing with non-physical properties. You got all the physical properties over here. It doesn't seem like they match up at all. And so there's no way to account for how they're tied together or how they interact with each other. And I think the situation is just worse. So, you know, in my mind, I'm attracted a bit more to these physicalist theories than dualism, probably towards emergentism as the best candidate for doing justice to the subjectivity of experience. And for Data, I sort of think, you know, I think if functionalism is true, I'm not too optimistic that Data is really conscious. Is the long and the short of it, right? If we really want to explain the consciousness of Data, we need to explain how that subjective experience arises out of whatever's going on in the brain, and not just map it out in terms of input and output conditions. Not just explain it away by saying Data's consciousness is just is his positronic brain, like identity theory holds. Not that you know, his emotions with his emotion chip are just defined in terms of his behaviors, right? There's something more subjective to his experience than that if Data is really conscious. So I think emergentism is probably the best bet. You know, it still has its challenges, but that's probably the closest one we've got.
And for all of our fans, or for all of our Voyager fans out there, everything that Zachary just said related to the Doctor, or related to Data, rather, we can apply to the Doctor. So feel free to give that a go and play with your own ideas and theories. I just want to say I'm probably a little bit more on the other side of this, what you referred to as spooky dualism. I'm probably a little bit
pejoratively.
I'm probably a little bit more over on that side. But as I said earlier, I'm kind of stuck in the middle, Zachary, because I don't feel like any of these physicalist theories really do justice as far as answering this question or solving this mystery of consciousness. On the same hand, I also see where it's very easy to kind of poke holes in this idea of dualism. Star Trek, surprisingly, makes pretty good arguments for both. And I just want to say to...
Yeah. Star Trek's goal is to tell a good story, right? So Star Trek, you know, it's still a drama and it still has to tell a good story. And, you know, all of these issues aside, Star Trek's going to do whatever it takes to tell a good story.
Right.
And that's more important for Star Trek than any of these issues.
That's exactly right. And I just want to say to our listeners out there, you know, we mentioned a lot of episodes today on today's episode of Metatrex. Turnabout Intruder, Enemy Within. Go and watch these episodes. We always hope here on Metatrex to engage listeners in these philosophical discussions, hey, get on the Babel conference and start a conversation. You don't have to know all of the terminology or be versed in theories. Just jump in there and start a conversation. We want to encourage our listeners to watch the episodes that we mention in our podcasts. I mentioned Turnabout Intruder, Enemy Within, Spock's Brain. We hovered on quite a bit. Again, probably not one of the most popular episodes, but for those of you out there that tend to lean towards more towards the physicalist theories, like Zachary today, I think Spock's Brain would actually surprise, and I don't mean this in a punny way, would provoke some thought. I think Best of Both Worlds, both those episodes.
You know you're going off the rails if you're recommending people watch Spock's Brain, right? Okay, we might be off the rails by default.
No, I'll defend Spock's Brain. I really will.
We'll have to get Larry Nemechek on here to settle that one.
Come on, Larry. Help me out. The Borg episodes, Scorpion, Best of Both Worlds, I, Borg, any episode that examines Seven of Nine, Tuvix, The Passenger, for all of you Enterprise fans out there, The Forge Awakening, Kirshara, all explore in those episodes what Zach and I were discussing today with Star Trek III and, you know, Spock's Katra. Those are all great episodes for you to dive into and watch.
I would also add maybe the Q episodes are a great example, because Q is an essentially non-physical consciousness, sure, right? In Star Trek. Maybe any episode where you get disembodied, non-physical energy beings, or you know, anything like that is sort of plays with the idea of consciousness, and then you have to ask the hard questions. What is it, you know, is this kind of consciousness plausible? Yes, it's in the story, right? But is it plausible? Can you imagine a being that's really like this? Is this adding anything to the discussion of consciousness? Or is it purely to tell a good story, yeah, right? Or can you learn any lessons about consciousness from those episodes? I think it's an open question.
Yeah, I mentioned before, a fun episode for exploration in mind-body dualism would be Body and Soul. That's a fun episode. You get to see what I think is probably one of Jerry Ryan's best performances on Voyager. A lot of great episodes to explore this topic. And again, we want to invite our listeners to continue the discussion in the Babel Conference. And I noticed today our episode 12 has gotten some conversation started, and we just want to encourage you to do that. And for my final thoughts today, I don't think Star Trek really settles this in any definitive way. I don't know that the discussion today is really going to change anybody's mind as to where they stand on the issue. I hope, though, at least my hope here is that maybe perhaps for someone who's not really given this a lot of philosophical thought, you know, maybe they'll pause for a moment and really think about, you know, their own assumptions on the topic of consciousness and just think it out, talk it out, again, get involved in the discussion, watch a little Star Trek, and let it provoke some thought. That's my hope, at least today, Zach, and that's pretty much my final thoughts.
I want to follow up on that just a second, Mike. I should say too that, you know, when we advocate for a position on Metatrex, or when we think about the complexity of these issues, or we recommend, you know, go think about this a little more, you know, by no means are we sort of advocating for a final solution to these problems, right? I think the important thing about all the issues, this one in particular, because consciousness, like I said, is one of the hard problems in philosophy, but in general, philosophical problems are hard, right? And we really want to do justice to the complexity of the issues. We want people to think about, you know, the reasons for and against different positions. Every one of these positions, including the ones that, you know, like I mentioned, for example, that emergentism, I think, is probably the most plausible of these positions. There's problems with that view, right, that we can talk about. And, you know, unfortunately, we only have an hour and a half here per episode, so we can't go into every nuance and every criticism and whatnot. But the goal is not to try to convince you of that our positions mm-hmm. are correct, right? The goal is to really lay out the complexity of the issues, talk about some of the reasons for and against each of the positions, and recognize that there's no chance we're going to settle these issues here on this podcast. Probably no chance any one of us will be the final word on any of these issues in general and philosophy, right? These are ongoing living issues that are complex, and we really want to do justice to that complexity and the fact that these are open questions. So in my mind, you know, I hope everyone, you know, when they watch Star Trek now, I hope you listeners out there, you know, to have some of this background in mind when you encounter some of these issues in Star Trek. I hope you know, have your own thoughts, you know, as you reflect on what it's like to be consciousness and how that could be related to whatever's going on inside your brain. You realize, hey, those don't add up as easily as we think they do, and think about what a plausible solution to that problem might be, and maybe even go out and do some research and read about different positions, read some of the criticisms of these different positions. If that spawns you to be curious and go out and do some further thinking and some further research, even better. But if you just want to sit back and watch Star Trek and maybe have some of this in the background when you watch Star Trek, that's great. But by no means are we trying to say we've got the answer to these
Absolutely
problems.
Not.
In fact, especially for consciousness, but also in any other episode we've had so far and any other philosophical topic, all of these questions are open philosophical questions. And I think that's what puts them in the category of philosophy versus a well-defined science. Presumably there are answers, right? We are conscious and we do have bodies and brains and we live in a physical world that has properties. So presumably there is an answer to these questions. Just no one knows what it is and what the best answer to these questions are. So again, I just want to reiterate, join the discussion, join us on the Babel conference and throw your thoughts out there. We don't worry about whether you understand philosophy or not, whether you've well understood everything we've said or still have a bunch of questions about things we talked about today. Just join the discussion and we'll keep the discussion alive. That's what we hope to do after the shows on the Babel conference. We're always around to answer questions, and if you have thoughts or questions or suggestions, anything like that, we're always around to engage, and we just want to keep the discussion going. These questions are part of what makes us human, right? The fact that we can ask questions about our own consciousness. Think how many life forms and how many types of things in the universe can't ask those questions, and we have that ability. So, you know, take a little time and turn your mind inward and ask, what really does it mean to be conscious, and how is that related to what I experience in the physical world out there? And you know, if we make any headway, great. If we only have a better time watching Star Trek because of it, so much the better.
And the great thing about philosophy, and for that matter, Star Trek, Zachary, and today is a great example. You and I don't necessarily agree on our own personal leanings on this topic. And so I think, you know, one of the greatest compliments is, you know, respectful disagreement in terms of, you know, conversation and engaging one another in discussion about this or any other philosophical topic or Star Trek topic. It's a very, very idic concept to just agree and disagree and question and discuss and come to a better understanding, I think, in the end.
Yeah, and I think with this topic in particular, it's not that disagreement connotes any sort of any sort of judgment, right?
I'm no, not
judging you
not.
Because you're a dualist. You're not judging me because I have more physicalist leanings. The problem with this topic in particular is that there's good reasons for every one of these positions, right? There are good reasons to be a dualist, right? The qualitativeness of experience. There's good reasons to be a physicalist. The success of neuroscience and the close relationship there seems to be between the mind and the brain, and all of these positions have good reasons for them. So it's not that anyone's like missing the point if you disagree, right? It's that there are good reasons, and it's hard to see how all those good reasons reconcile with each other.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And I take no exception at all to being,
even though you're a dualist, called I still
a
like
spooky
you.
Dualist.
Yeah. Yeah, there is kind of this pejorative way of calling, you know, dualism. Oh, that's just spooky metaphysics, right? You know?
Yeah. Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about the mystery of consciousness in Star Trek today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
It would be a lot of fun to be able to MST3K an episode like Arena, which, who doesn't love poking fun at a rock-throwing Gorn? I mean, come on, you know?
Can you find a rudimentary lathe?
Exactly. I wrote that on the Babel conference today because Guy Fleegman from Galaxy Quest is the greatest character ever.
Earl Grey.
This 547-meter-long, 32-deck, 502-crew member.
That's awesome.
To the journey!
Now we go to Once Upon a Time.
Yeah.
Neelix tries to... Warp 5.
If they could have kind of told us, it's more of a future for us, but we're going to build up to the Star Trek you know. And Larry's comment back was, well, that would mean that they kind of were planning it out and they knew what they were doing ahead of time.
Buzzing.
That sounds right. Like Larry.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
I will say, if you want to see what it's really like when someone slices open a tauntaun to get inside to stay warm, like in the real world.
Yeah.
That was the best part of the movie. I'm like, really? Han Solo made it look so easy. This is what happens? This is terrifying.
The 602 Club.
It's about that transformation of getting Oliver to be able to see themselves as something more than vigilantes, but being heroes.
Yeah, and there is a lot of... I like that because there is a lot in the quote unquote, as you're calling it, the island story, which the island now is Hong Kong, as you pointed out.
Yeah,
earlier.
I mean, yeah, it's a little bigger than an island.
Literary Treks.
Dan, are you sure that flavor isn't something like a green liquid voodoo drink?
Oh, man. This.
Because that could be the flavor that we're going for. Boy.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these and other shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out tremendously, and it makes it so much easier for listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, hey, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include things like early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits on our shows, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts, which we'd love to hear, on anything that we discuss in any episode of Metatrex, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form at trek.fm/contact.
If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our show page on the Trek FM website or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
And we're on Twitter as well. Our username is @trekfm.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/trekfm.
And we're always around the Babel Conference. Type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. The Babel Conference is our listeners-only discussion group, so join us and get in on the discussion.
We'd also like to invite you to leave a rating and a review of Metatrex on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. And Mike, we said at the beginning of the show that we would announce some of the kind people who've taken the time to leave us a rating and a review of Metatrex on iTunes so far, and you have a grand list of all of our reviewers.
We do have a list of reviewers. Many on the US iTunes store, as well as a couple in the UK and Canadian iTunes stores. DZE Fries gave us a 4-star rating. It said enjoyable and informative. Angel Finally. This was an interesting one, Zachary, in the U.S. store. Gave us 5 stars and said, so smart it hurts. And Angel, all I can say is we are deeply sorry. We never intend to cause discomfort to our listeners.
We also bring the medicine.
We also bring the medicine. Duncan Barrett from the UK store, 4 stars. We have
Exran Som, Exransom, there we go, from the U.S. store, 5 stars. DJ Shea from the Canadian store. We have Ainsley Hayes from the U.S. store. We have 17 Brian from the U.S. store. And kapla to you, 17 Brian. We have Christopher Settle from the U.S. store, 5 stars. We have C.D. Chapin, 10, from the U.S. store, gave us a 5-star rating and a review. Chiquita, I like this one, Chiquita Banana 1984, gave us a rating on the U.S. store. We had Rachel from STL in the U.S. store, 5 stars. Nerds Abounding, she says, I like that one. At 23 from the U.K. store, 5 stars, says it's great. And C.D. Spock from the U.S. store gave us a 5-star rating. And he said, Zachary, making philosophy fun.
Well, mission accomplished. What more could we ask?
Mission accomplished. And you've got a couple there as well that you'd like to read in detail, Zachary.
I do. I've got a rating here from a user named Tempest in Blue. And this individual says, I love this show. Star Trek is so well known for presenting such interesting and complicated philosophical issues. So I'm glad to have found a podcast that goes so into depth into them. The hosts are engaging, articulate, and clearly know their stuff. I feel like I've gained a better understanding of the issues they've discussed from a few hours of listening to the show than I ever did in university. And that's high praise. So thank you very much for that, Tempest in Blue, whoever you are.
That is high praise.
I'd also like to read a quick one from a user named 1K Squared, and this individual says, being a Trek fan for a long time, I've always known the show had many religious and philosophical implications. This show is an examination of a lot of those implications in a highly insightful way. Topics are discussed rationally with many references to philosophical schools of thought and individual philosophers. I love this program because it allows you to enjoy Star Trek in an entirely different way while examining the true significance of the show. So once again, thanks to everyone who's taken the time to leave a rating and review. Those are there's no way to convey how satisfying we find the reviews. Those of you out there who are finding what we're doing valuable and interesting and keep tuning in every week, we really appreciate it. The network as a whole appreciates it. We appreciate it. And it warms our hearts on the inside to hear such great reviews. So thank you very much. We would also like to remind you that if you are one of our international listeners, be sure to remind us and just let us know on Twitter or on the Babel conference that you've left us a review in one of the international stores so we can take the time to go look at the review you've left. Unfortunately, the different iTunes stores are not linked together. So, there's 50 or 100 different iTunes stores out there around the world, and it's more than we can keep track of day in, day out. So do us a favor, and if you do leave us a review in one of the international stores, just drop us a quick note and let us know, and we'll go take a look and send you some thanks afterwards.
Absolutely. We want to recognize those reviewers on the show, maybe even hear your review read right here on the podcast.
Well, Mike, when you are not probing the mystery of consciousness, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs these days?
Well, Zachary, of course, Facebook on the Babel Conference. I'm also a frequent contributor to Warp 5, a show for which I am associate producer of, and on a couple of recent episodes of The Ready Room, as well as Twitter, my username at cmichael1701. And Zachary, when your consciousness isn't floating around from place to place, where can our listeners find you?
Well, you can find me all over the network, but you can find me on several recent episodes of Trek FM's flagship show, The Ready Room. You can also find me on Facebook in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listener group, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. You can always comment on anything we talked about in the show or toss some ideas our way in the Babel Conference. And you can also find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, Zachary Fruhling. That's ZACHARYFRUHLING.
We'd also like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team from the network. Specifically, we want to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM. Thank you, Chris, for all that you do to improve and increase fandom around the world. Our executive producer, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, Norman Lau. Our creative, uber creative art director, Aaron Harvey. Will Wen, our content manager, Richard Marquez, who works every day to bring our podcast to our listeners, production manager, Dennis Costello, our fabulous editor and producer. Thank you all so much for everything that you do. And thank you to our listeners for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.
In the Klingon Empire, the pants wear you.